The opinions and views expressed in Dead Men Do Tell Tales and all affiliated media are Jordan and Nicole's and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of their training program or others working in the field of medico-legal death investigation. Hey everyone.
Welcome to Dead Men Do Tell Tales,
a podcast about forensic pathology related topics.
I'm Nicole Kroom.
And I'm Jordan Taylor.
And we're both pathology residents who are going into forensic pathology.
And because this is coming out the day before Halloween, we figured we would do an episode on witches. And this kind of came up because when we were doing our episode on coroners versus medical examiners, in the state of Connecticut, and I'll go a little more into the story later, we talked a little bit about how an autopsy was used to determine if somebody was a witch or not. So we figured it would be an interesting topic to both research and relevant to the very important holiday.
Yes.
So, and also, fair warning, my very black cat, also very appropriately Halloween-themed Cole, is out and about and very hyper. So if you hear a bell clinging or random thumps, that's probably her being mischievous,
yeah,
as always. So witchcraft, the word itself, the etymology of it, the base of that word, witch, comes from English related words, the root of which is like vite or vide, so which translates into wise. So it's a thought of like witchcraft is craft of the wise, is one of the theories from where the word actually came from. And then the kind of definition of witchcraft is the practice of magical skills and abilities. And of course, this definition varies across cultures. In Africa and the African diaspora and indigenous communities, it's often a metaphysical means to cause harm to the innocent. It's thought of that way. Versus in kind of the modern era, when you think of like the Wiccan and whatnot, it's this benign, positive, or neutral practice of modern paganism.
Yeah.
So there's a really wide variety of what people define as witchcraft. And it's often present within societies and groups whose cultural framework includes a magical worldview, which kind of makes sense. And when I was thinking about this, my first thought when I think of witches is the Salem witch trials and Christianity. And when I innately think of Christianity, I don't really think of magic. But then you think back to some of the miracles and like turning water into wine,
yeah,
and all of this stuff. You realize that a lot of it is more quote unquote magical than, I don't know, what I kind of was brought up thinking about it.
So are you trying to tell me that Jesus was a witch?
I will let you come to your own conclusions on that.
Oh my God.
Well, would he be a... Yeah, I guess. So also, when I think of male witch, thanks to Harry Potter, I think wizard.
Right.
But in all of this research, everybody is always just called a witch. So, except there was one part that something came up as wizardry later on, but it was the only time I ever saw wizard referred to.
Yeah, that's true. I never saw wizard come up in this either. I saw
sorcery
come up,
yeah,
but not sorcerer either. So, yeah, I wonder when male witches started being called wizard.
Well, I wonder...
Wizard.
Yeah, there was one... Right, it was like 1833. We'll talk about it when we get into America. I had wizardry come up once. But, well, when I think of like... Oh, what was his name? Merlin.
Yes.
Right? But he was supposed to be in like the time of Arthur, right?
So right.
Like the 14, 1500s. But that was... He was a wizard.
Yes.
So I don't know. It's weird because in all of this research, I only ever saw witch.
Nobody that was ever the called. Weirdest part of the research for you was not seeing.
That was one of the weird parts of the research for me. Especially when I saw wizardry come up at the end. And I was just like, oh, right. That's what we all think of it as nowadays.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was interesting. Wizard. Witchcraft has kind of, and the witchcraft and the belief of witchcraft has kind of been around for as long as humans probably have been around. But there aren't a lot of great documented things about it early on because we didn't really document things early on.
kind of hard to do without a writing system.
Exactly. Ooh, Cole is now on top of the recording box. Hi. Yeah. So the first mention I saw time-wise was the old Near East beliefs, kind of widespread in the ancient Near East and Nile Valley around like 2000 BC. It was an interesting quote from this that I found different. If a man has put a spell upon another man and it's not justified, he upon who the spell is laid, so the one that was like the receiver of said spell,
yes,
shall go to the holy river. Into the holy river he shall plunge. If the holy river overcame him and he is drowned, the man who put a spell upon him shall take possession of the house. If the holy river declares him innocent and he remains unharmed, the man who laid the spell shall be put to death. So it's kind of backwards. It almost like it put the blame on the receiver.
Even if it was not justified?
Yes. It's only if it's not justified.
Yeah, that's weird.
It's just so different. Oh, yeah. And then if you're deemed innocent, you get possession of the other guy's stuff. Yeah. But if you're dead, the person that cast the spell on you is now gets all your stuff.
Huh. I wonder what the prevalence of knowing how to swim was back then. Because I feel like
what you were weighed
down.
You
have a curse, and you have a curse. Now I have five houses. This is great.
Just take over the Nile Valley.
Yeah, that's exactly it. Things I would do if I went back in time.
Right. And then within a lot of religions, as we said, in the Bible, in the Old Testament, the New Testament, all of it, there's a lot of mention of miraculous things, including distinct laws against witchcraft.
Mm-hmm.
And I found it interesting. There was one quote from my friend Wikipedia that said, per the New Advent Catholic Encyclopedia, so an encyclopedia on Catholic things, in the Holy Scripture, references to sorcery are frequent, and the strong condemnations of such practices found there do not seem to be based so much upon the supposition of fraud as in the abomination of the magic itself. So it's not on the fact that you're defrauding somebody and you're doing somebody wrong. It's on the fact that you are using magic at all.
Oh.
Which seems weird.
Yeah.
But I guess that does make sense when you think about, like, the biblical references to magic. It's don't do magic. It's not don't do magic to the wrong people, you know?
Right.
It's all on the magic itself.
I guess that makes sense.
Which is very...
Not that I'm super familiar with biblical stories of witchcraft.
And then, of course, from the Western world, the Old Testament distinctly lays down a lot of laws against witchcraft. So that's kind of how we get into, I don't know about you, but what I think of as the more witchcrafty witchcraft.
Yes, that is also what I think about when I think about the, like, 1500s in Europe and then the 1600s in the U.S.
America,
yes.
Pre-America.
The colonies, I guess, before it was called.
It was always funny when I was writing down Colony of Connecticut, Colony of Massachusetts Bay. It was just like, oh, right, they weren't states then. Because I grew up in Connecticut and I lived in Massachusetts for 6 years. So it was just strange.
You didn't still call it the Colony of Connecticut?
I should have called it the Colony of Connecticut. Did you know that Connecticut was founded by Thomas Hooker for more fertile soil? Which I will never forget, because when you're in eighth grade and you have the words hooker and fertile in the same sentence.
Oh, of course.
You'll never forget it. And you're like, this is my state.
Now I'll never forget it. I'm sure at one point I knew it was founded by Thomas Hooker, but definitely not for reasons of it being fertile.
Yep. Yep.
Sexy.
Oh yeah, Connecticut. First thing I think of, sexy.
Those down jackets, man. You need to survive the winters. So according to the timeline, I found witch hysteria, so actively seeking out witches and then punishing them for using magic, really took hold in Europe during the mid-1400s, and that was when many accused witches confessed, often under torture, to a variety of wicked behaviors. And within a century, witch hunts were very commonplace, and most of the accused were executed by burning at the stake or hanging. Mm-hmm. And single women, widows, and other women on the margins of society were especially targeted.
Yes.
Which made me wonder if I should be worried about you. Especially given that you recently acquired a black cat.
The other part of it, though, that I read, that they were also less likely to have defenders. But I would have my rugby team backing me. Although that is just a giant group of women who... they also might not care if they're defending me or not, so.
Well, as long as there were enough of you to defend against yourselves in that group, I feel like the town wouldn't be able to.
Also, to be fair, do you really want to face a group of rugby women?
No, absolutely not.
Exactly. power.
So between the years 1500 and 1660, it's estimated that up to 80,000 suspected witches were put to death in Europe, which is a megaton of people.
So too many people.
Yeah. And apparently Germany had the highest witchcraft execution rate, while Ireland had the lowest. And that's probably because there was a publication of something called the Malleus Maleficarum, which was written by two very well-respected German Dominicans in 1486. And it's suspected that this book likely spurred witch mania to go viral, as it were. And the title of the book is usually translated to The Hammer of Witches. And it was basically a guide on how to identify, hunt, and interrogate witches. So it labeled witchcraft as heresy, and it quickly became the authority for Protestants and Catholics trying to flesh out witches living amongst them.
Oh, goody.
So for more than 100 years, the book actually sold more copies of any other book in Europe, except for the Bible.
Huh.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yep.
The specifics that I had in Europe were more on, like, the UK setting. In Wales, again, 1500s-ish, there was a growing alarm of women's magic as a weapon aimed against the state and church. And so to fight this, the church tried to enforce these laws of marriage, which was, this is just general UK, but especially in Wales, because apparently their traditions allowed a, quote, wider range of sexual partnerships. So essentially it sounds like there was maybe more sexual freedom and they were against this. So it's like, let's start making everybody witches.
Oh.
And then we can say, no, you're against the laws of the church, so you must be a witch, and et cetera, et cetera. It seems like from all of this, my next one's going to be the same thing. It's just like, let's marginalize this group of women and say they're witches.
Because women are scary.
They,
and
we
sex
are.
Is scary. So
that's,
it's like,
that's true.
You know.
It's a horrible, horrible thing.
Yeah.
Why would anybody do it? Pun intended. And the other part of that, and I found interesting. So in 1603, James I, one of his parents was king of Scotland and the other parent was in line to be a king of England. And then when the Queen of England died, who wasn't his mom, but he was the next in line.
Okay.
He became both king of Scotland and England and Ireland. So this is when they were the first time they were under the same crown.
Oh.
And in Scotland, there was already a, like, this big threat, for lack of a better word, of witchcraft. So he brought to England and Scotland this continental explanations of witchcraft. And they thought at this time it was to, nowadays, they think it was to divert the suspicion away from male homosociality among the elite.
Oh.
And focus on female communities and large gatherings of women. Because
wow.
He thought that the women threatened his political power. So he laid this foundation for witchcraft and occultism. That deprived women of political influence. And they said that this occult power was a womanly trait because women are weaker and more susceptible to be a witch.
My mouth just dropped.
Literally.
Open.
I can vouch for that.
Wow.
So essentially, straight up, they didn't want women to have any power. So they started marginalizing them any way they could. It's just the old ways of doing this.
History is, you know, like my favorite thing.
Repetitive. In 1944, Helen Duncan, 1944, this like less than 100 years ago, was the last person in Britain to be imprisoned for fraudulently claiming to be a witch.
Really?
1944.
Whoa.
But yeah, so England kind of kicked it off and then it made its way over into the U.S., so in the American colonies, the first accusation of witchcraft was in Springfield, Mass in 1645. This is when Hugh and Mary Parsons, husband and wife, accused each other of witchcraft for killing their child.
Oh, okay. That's not... That's
funny. But it was one of those... I didn't look too much into this story, but they found Hugh innocent. Mary was acquitted of witchcraft, but then sentenced to hang for the death of her child. Which, again, I didn't look into it much, I didn't fully understand, but she was sentenced, but not because of witchcraft. And then she ended up dying in prison, so she wasn't hung, but she wasn't actually accused of witchcraft, but it was the first trial.
Huh.
And then between 1645 to 1663, 80 people in the Massachusetts Bay Colony were accused of practicing witchcraft. And in that same time frame, 13 women and 2 men were executed in New England. And then actually, everybody associates just Massachusetts with witchcraft because everybody thinks of the Salem witch trials, which were 1692 to 1693, when a lot of people were accused and executed for obviously being witches.
Yeah.
The first person that was actually hung for witchcraft was in Connecticut in 1647. So the first accusation was 45 in Massachusetts. But then 2 years later, in 1647, Alice Young was hung for suspected witchcraft. The reason that Connecticut, I think, was able to get a jump on Massachusetts for this is because in 1650, they enacted what are called the Blue Laws. And if you were in Connecticut when I was a kid, you knew the Blue Laws because you couldn't buy alcohol on Sunday. It's essentially a bunch of things that the Puritans enacted to control morality because alcohol is very amoral. And when you went to the grocery store, you saw these like almost like curtains pulled down over the beer.
Oh.
So you couldn't, like, I mean, you could see it through the slats, but it was like, so you can't buy beer on Sundays. And those laws have been repealed now. I think there's limited hours that you now can buy beer and liquor on Sundays. But when I was a kid, I think it was mid to late 2010s that they repealed these laws. But it covered a lot of things. And it in these blue laws, they stipulated the death penalty for witchcraft. And I'm just going to read it because I love the old English. If any man or woman be a witch that is hath or consulteth with a familiar spirit, they shall be put to death. And spirit has two R's and two T's.
Of course. We should continue to spell it that way.
Yes. And then, if any person shall slay another through guile, either by poisonings or other such devilish practice, he shall be put to death. And B has two E's, because...
Yeah. B.
B. And then, from 1647, over the next 50 years, 10 more suspected witches were executed. Connecticut kind of had a jump on Massachusetts, and then Massachusetts kind of ran away with the gold.
Does that make you upset?
I'm okay with not winning this race.
Oh, yeah?
We've won plenty of other races. The reason this came up in our earlier episode is because the first medico-legal investigation of death in the United States was in 1662 in Connecticut, and it was related to witchcraft. So Nicole and I usually each do a story. We're going to not do them at the end. I'm going to do mine now because it fits in with the timeline. And then Nicole will do hers a little bit later. So mine is on the death of Elizabeth Kelly. This is an 8-year-old girl who is in Hartford, Connecticut, which is the state capital. She had been ill for several days. And now with looking back and our medical knowledge, I think it was probably a bronchial pneumonia. So lung, big airway disease. And a neighbor, the good wife, Goody Ayers, also Goody Ayers is like the perfect witch name.
Yeah.
Just saying. For all of this, it's just, they chose the right person, name-wise, to accuse.
Maybe that's why she did it.
Because of her name. Oh, man. And so she had shared a bowl of broth with this young girl. And then that night, this girl became sick. And she had 5 days of prolonged stomach pains and then associated delusions, which when little kids get sick and feverish, they can definitely get delusional. So this, again, on the edge of this not being witchcraft, feverish kids can get delusional. The parents testified that she exclaimed, quote, "Father, Father, help me, help me. Goodwife Ayers is upon me. She chokes me. She kneels on my belly. She will break my bowel. She pinches me. She will make me black and blue. Goodwife Ayers torments me. She pricks me with pins. She will kill me. Oh, Father, set on the great furnace and scald her. Get the broad axe and cut off her head." Which, I don't know about you, but when I was 8 years old, I wouldn't been able to think of all those threats from another person on me.
I hope that I would not have, but I also watched a lot of Law and Order type TV shows that I probably shouldn't have been watching.
You were eight? I feel like eight is one of those ages that, like, voodoo threats I wouldn't get, right? Because, like, the pricks with pins.
They were just more mature back then, question mark?
Watching all the voodoo shows up.
Yeah, I guess.
1650s. And so, by the time that Elizabeth died, everyone knew of these accusations of her delusional, understandably, rantings. And there were also rumors that Goodwife Ayers enjoyed spreading stories of encounters with the devil. She did have a husband. She wasn't like a single woman living out on the side of the farm. She was married with a child. And then they brought Goody Ayers to the bedside of the deceased child, and they rolled up the kid's sleeve to see like bruises on her upper arms and shoulders. And apparently a red spot appeared on the kid's cheek on the side that Goody Ayers was standing. And they were like, this is ominous. It must be her.
Mm-hmm.
Because of this, because of all these things, they wanted to do an autopsy on the kid to determine if it was in fact witchcraft or not. So they recruited this guy. I saw Brian and Bray in different places, but last name Rositer, who's from Guilford, Connecticut, and was the founder of the Windsor Colony, which is one of the old Connecticut colonies, to perform this autopsy. So two things of note. One, we have no idea what his medical training is, but he was granted permission to act as a physician in the colony. And two, Guilford is about 20 miles from Hartford. So, you know, for the car, 20-minute drive, when you had maybe a horse, maybe you're on foot, it took a while. So he wasn't able to perform this autopsy until 5 days postmortem.
Mm-hmm.
This will be important later. And of course, this was the 1662. There was no refrigeration. There was no anything. So this was in March, which is still cool in Connecticut, but it's not like a refrigerated unit. So definitely not ideal storage. So I won't read out the entire autopsy, but I'll read out some important parts of it. So upon the opening of John Kelly's child at the grave, they also did this autopsy graveside.
Efficiency? Question mark.
I think they also probably just didn't have better facilities anywhere. Like, where else are you going to do it? Yours is going to be messy. You probably don't trust cleaning up as much.
That's true.
Like, I don't know. I'm sure they didn't do all the many autopsies back then. They said the whole body, the muscular parts, nerves, and joints were all pliable without stiffness or contraction. And he said that his experience of dead bodies renders such symptoms as unusual. He noted this deep blue tincture all over the body, so like kind of a deep blue bruise along the body. Said that there was no obvious mass amounts of blood in any of the cavities, but that along the throat there was a lot of blood at the very swallow that he couldn't like swipe away with his finger, so it wasn't like loose blood, it was like real blood, quote unquote. He said there was the appearance of pure fresh blood on the backside of the arm. This is one of my favorite lines ever. The bladder of gall was all broken and curded, without any tincture on the adjacent parts. I love it because we say gallbladder now.
Yeah.
And in anatomic pathology, when you're talking about like gallbladders and then like your urinary bladder, one of our attendings is very distinct on making you say urinary bladder and not just bladder. And I didn't realize until reading this, it's like, I think of gallbladder as its own thing, but yeah. I guess it used to be called the bladder of gall. So just bladder alone wouldn't distinguish between the gall one and the urinary one. Although anybody today would think bladder and think the urine one.
Right.
But it's interesting. And then finally, the gullet or swallow was contracted like a hard fishbone that hardly a large piece could be forced through. And there's a lot of weird spelling because Old English, but it's... So the esophagus and the trachea were super tight. And because of these findings and because of his vast experience, he concluded that Elizabeth Kelly had suffered unnatural harm. He never said witchcraft, but he did not say witchcraft. And Ayers and her husband fled to avoid execution. They actually ended up leaving their son behind. And he was eventually put as an apprentice to a cooper. And... of course, nowadays, we know that every single one of these can be attributed to decomposition.
Yeah.
They're all just various things that you see. Your joints, like, yes, you get stiff right after you die, but a little bit later, once you've decomposed a little bit more, your joints will be loosened up. You do have bleeding in weird places. So you have purge fluid that might have been this neck thing.
Mm.
Your throat / esophagus could get more contracted when things are just happen in a weird way, and every single one of these could 100% be described by decomposition. And understandably, they hadn't experienced this.
Yeah.
But this is the first time that somebody was autopsied and the autopsy quote unquote proved witchcraft. And then after this case, over the next year, 10 witches were accused and 4 were murdered. So in this 1 year span alone, because of this doctor that didn't know what decomposition was, said that this was atypical and essentially accused this person of witchcraft, and many, many people died.
Yeah.
And then the other, I'm just going to throw this in here because geographically it kind of fits. The Navajo had their own version of witchcraft, as we would call it witchcraft, with skinwalkers, which are, you know, people that they say can turn into essentially animals. And they also had this stuff called corpse powder, which was powder made from corpses.
Oh.
That is used in witchcraft. That's about all I got, because apparently, understandably, the Navajo, any culture doesn't want to talk to other people outside of their culture about them. So they don't really talk to people outside of their own community about witchcraft. But those are the two interesting things. One, a lot of people know about skinwalkers from, like, pop culture. But then the corpse powder was the interesting part to me. So the last thing that we wanted to touch on is kind of some of the modern beliefs around the world around quote-unquote witchcraft. And we're using that term more loosely based on kind of the Western thought of witchcraft and placing it onto other cultures. So they might not call it witchcraft, but it's our belief of this magic slash supernatural thing that is enacting on humans and causing some kind of quote supernatural changes. I feel like Africa has a bunch, so I'm going to go through that. I have 2 non-African ones real quick, just briefly. And again, these are all ongoing things. So in India, there's still ongoing belief and prosecution of witchcraft. And in 2008, in the state of Chhattisgarh, I think, at least 100 women in that year were maltreated as suspected witches. So in 1 year, there's at least 100 women. That was a little over 10 years ago. But many women are still being maltreated because they're thought of as witches. And then in Saudi Arabia, there's still a death penalty for sorcery and witchcraft. Oof. It's 2019. It's just absolutely insane.
They actually recently, in 2017, I believe, the UN held an experts workshop on witchcraft and human rights.
Huh.
Yeah. And so a bunch of experts from around the world got together to discuss like the definition of witchcraft and the ways in which a belief in witchcraft has been linked to human rights violations in different countries. Mm-hmm. And so some of the statistics that they had were, in a study of about 41 countries around the world, there were estimated over 800 abused or killed in 2013 for alleged witchcraft. And that is definitely an underestimate since a lot of cases go unreported. And then a lot of the speakers came from Africa because the belief in witchcraft is so prevalent there.
Yeah.
So according to the United Nations High Commission on Refugees, there are about 25 to 50,000 children living on the streets of Kinshasa, the capital of the Democratic Republic of Congo, and many of them were abandoned for being thought of as possessed.
Yep.
So actually the story that I'm going to talk about later is a child who her family thought she was possessed and the sequelae of that.
Yeah, a lot. It seems like a lot of the African countries, the stuff that I read was a lot of children being accused of things.
Yeah.
It was some women, but it was a lot more children versus a lot of European slash brought into American stuff was women. But a lot of this African stuff, including that one that I read, which was scary, is a lot of children. Just a very interesting focus. Because I feel like in Europe, when you think of them focusing on women, a lot of it is to marginalize this group of society.
Right.
But with children, you think that you want to raise them to grow up and become your society. Why isolate them now? It just doesn't... It's harder for me to wrap my head around as to like a reason... You know?
Yeah. And I didn't see anything specifically about that in my research either, like why the focus has shifted from women to children as being the practitioners.
Yeah.
So according to some of the things I was reading, beliefs in witchcraft and mysticism, they believe are cropping up in these developing countries, mostly because of things like environmental crises, political volatility, and then other things such as like the Ebola epidemic. So these big things that are really terrible and can't be described, not as readily by science, but like these huge, terrible things that seem to have no purpose are being attributed to witchcraft and other mystical practices.
One interesting thing I saw in Ghana was that it seemed like in Ghana it was more women that were accused of witchcraft, but these women would form these witch camps.
Yes.
That women can go to for safety and kind of form a coalition and protect themselves against this, which is just fantastic. People banding together to save themselves. Also, I think it was Ghana and I think the other one was DRC. They had the legend of penis snatchers, which, did you read this?
No, I did not.
This is crazy. So the theory is that whoever these are, and there was one country, I think it was a DRC, they accused children of it, and in Ghana they accused women of it, that they cast something on them that made the man's penis shrink.
Oh.
So it was, the penis was constantly shrinking. And the explanation for all of this was the man can now blame his impotence on others, but it also still follows this African belief of witches.
Oh.
So you can kind of blame something going on with you medically.
Yeah.
On somebody else while not having it be too weird. But yeah, I just read penis snatchers and I was like, what? And then I read more into it and I was like, that's, I don't know if it's scarier, but just still very scary.
Yeah, it's interesting that you mention the witchcraft being used as a reason for a medical issue, mm-hmm. because I did read this study called The Epidemiology of Bewitchment as a Lay Reported Cause of Death in Rural South Africa by Fortrell et al. And they looked at, well, autopsy is a very resource-intensive resource. So in a lot of developing countries, they don't have the ability to do autopsies. So they use these things called verbal autopsies. So a trained field worker interviews the closest caregiver of the deceased to retrospectively record the signs and symptoms of the deceased in order to try to develop a medically
a cause of death,
yeah, but like one that makes sense medically based on the signs and symptoms prior to death,
a medically relevant cause of death.
So they were looking at this system, surveillance system in South Africa called the Agincourt surveillance mm-hmm. system, and it covers 21 villages and a population of around 70,000 people. So this study was published in 2012, but they were looking at data gathered between 1992 and 2006, and there were 6,874 deaths that fell under this surveillance system, and of those, about 6% of the deaths, so 406 cases, had bewitchment labeled as the family perceived cause of death, so 6%.
I saw this article on like a couple months ago and I was like, I should send this to Nicole. She would love it. I should have sent it to you then.
Oh, you saw this article?
Yeah, I saw this article like months ago.
Oh, okay.
And it was on, I think, like our Diagnosis Daily or whatever. And I was like, oh, Nicole would love this. It's all epidemiology with autopsy.
Yeah, and actually when I heard about that UN Nations experts workshop on witchcraft and human rights, there was another one recently in January that took place in the UK.
Okay.
That was kind of a follow-up to that United Nations workshop. And I was just thinking, man, if somebody had told me in college that I could like specialize academically in witchcraft, I don't know if I would be here right now.
Well, I'm glad that you didn't find out until now.
Yeah. Guess what they say is it's never too late to change. anyway, so this study found that the odds...
No, if you focus on your autopsy training on witchcraft.
Yes.
And then you can approach it from that side.
You're right. You're right. You're right. You're right.
You can still reach your goals, Nicole.
Yeah, thank you. Everybody has their own little sub specialty within a field. Mine is going to be supernatural. I am Scully. Yes, I guess that's right. Yeah. But anyway, this study found that the odds of having your death reported as being due to bewitchment were significantly higher if the death was in a child or a woman of reproductive age, and then sudden deaths or those following acute illness, deaths occurring before 2001, and those where traditional healthcare was sought versus no healthcare were more likely to be attributed to bewitchment. Mm-hmm. And when they say traditional healthcare, they mean that the person went to just like the village healer versus trying to go to a Western medical care establishment. And when they were looking at this study, a lot of it, they found that people would not seek Western healthcare if they thought that the person's illness was due to bewitchment. because they thought that that meant Western medicine would not be able to do anything for them.
Gotcha. Yes. So they didn't, yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, I thought it was a really interesting that 6% of the deaths were attributed to bewitchment.
Yeah.
Which makes sense because there was also another statistic that said that, like, in Tanzania, like, 90%+ of the population believe in witchcraft. So it's, like, a very prevalent belief.
Distinctly in Tanzania, I saw that in 2008, the President Kikwete publicly condemned witch doctors for killing albinos. Because apparently albinos are sought after for their body parts because they're thought to bring good luck. So that's still a thing. It makes sense that they believe much more in witchcraft because they're actively killing people that they think could help them.
Yeah. One of the articles that I read that was talking about modern day witchcraft was saying that, you know, political instability can cause these crises of witch hunts. And there was an election that was happening, and a lot of the people that were running turned to black magic. And so in terms of the albino, like, there was a statistic that the price of an albino hand could go for as much as $46,000 during that time period, because it was seen as like a token for getting you the win for the election. But yeah, I guess some of the good news is that with things like this UN experts workshop and the recent conference that they had in the UK in January, that in a lot of these parts of the world, they are now trying to crack down on people who are hunting down witches and all of these human rights violations in reference to witchcraft. So like in 2013, Papua New Guinea repealed this 1971 Sorcery Act that had legitimized defense against witchcraft as an excuse for murder. And in 2006, the British government has been working with immigrant communities to tamp down on child abuse linked to witchcraft allegations. And then in a lot of African countries, there have been legislation enacted to criminalize witch hunt-induced violence. Although a lot of those aren't being as enforced as harshly as they could, so not 100% working, but there are efforts trying to tamp down on these violent acts.
The only other thing I had in Africa was there was this native belief in the Belgian Congo that only witches have stomachs. And in the old days, the unfortunate victim convicted of witchcraft was opened up to prove the statement, but everybody has stomachs. So right. If you open them up to prove they have a stomach and they have a stomach... So it was just interesting that that was one of the beliefs. And they probably didn't do autopsies on anybody else, because why would you?
Right.
So it was just one of the crazy, weird ways that humans can not have all the answers and try to make something fit, which doesn't fit.
Yeah. Yeah. Which always makes me think what we're going to find out in the future that we think now that is...
I think a lot of it's going to be psychiatry.
Ah.
A lot of the psych diseases that we have, depression, anxiety... schizophrenia, I think that we're going to get a better handle on those when we actually know the science. Because we're getting better at brain science, but we still don't know a lot about it.
Yeah.
And that's going to be the big thing. They're like, why would you ever do X, Y, or Z?
Right. So I guess that brings me to my story. So this one actually mainly takes place in the UK, but it is the murder of Victoria Climbier. So Victoria Climbier was born on November 2nd in 1991 in the Ivory Coast, and she was the fifth of seven children. And in October of 1998, when she was almost 7 years old, her great aunt Marie-Thérèse Puel, who lived in France, was visiting the family and offered to take one of the children back to France with her to arrange for their education, which apparently was not super uncommon in that society. So the family was actually really excited for that. And from that point onwards, Marie pretended that Victoria was her daughter. And they left the Ivory Coast around November 1998, flew to Paris, where Victoria was enrolled at school. However, by December of 1998, Marie, the caretaker, her aunt, began to receive warnings about Victoria's absenteeism. And in February of 1999, the school issued a child at risk notification and a social worker became involved. But on April 24th, 1999, Marie and Victoria left France and traveled to the UK. And between April 26th and early July 1999, Marie visited social services 18 times to try to get housing and financial support. Victoria was with her on at least 10 occasions when she made these visits to social services, and the staff noted that Victoria seemed really unkempt and kind of malnourished.
Okay.
However, they didn't take any action, and they assumed that the girl's appearance was a purposeful attempt to persuade the authorities to hand out more welfare money.
Oh.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So on June 8th of 1999, Marie got a job at a hospital, and during her first month of work, there apparently wasn't any effort made by her or social services to enroll Victoria in educational or daycare activities. So by the middle of June 1999, Victoria was spending most of her time at the home of Priscilla Cameron, who was an unregistered childminder who Marie met at her job at the hospital. And there's no evidence that Victoria was treated badly during her time with Cameron, but on several occasions, Cameron did observe small cuts to Victoria's fingers, and she asked Marie about them, and Marie said that they were caused by razor blades that Victoria was playing with at home.
Oh, good. That's my normal play toy.
Right. No red flags here. So on June 18th, 1999, a distant relative who occasionally visited Marie and Victoria anonymously telephoned social services and expressed some concern over Victoria's situation. But the officer who received the call, although she did forward it to the social work department, nobody picked up the referral that afternoon. And a few days later, the person who had made the report called again to make sure that her report was being followed up. And somebody said that, oh, it's been faxed to social services, you know, it's being taken care of, but nobody followed up on it and they didn't send another referral. So it wasn't actually until 3 weeks later that that first referral was seen. But by that time, Marie and Victoria had moved in with this man named Carl Manning that Marie had met on a bus that he was driving. So by the time social services followed up on this anonymous tip, they went to their apartment and nobody was there because they had moved in with this new boyfriend of Marie's. Later in the year, on July 13th, 1999, Victoria was being watched by Priscilla Cameron, and they noticed that she had numerous injuries, including a burn on her face and a loose piece of skin hanging from her right eyelid. And they asked Marie about it, but she said that the injuries were self-inflicted. But they were still concerned, so they took Victoria to the hospital the next day. Mm-hmm. And the doctors there were very concerned that this was non-accidental trauma. So they called the police and social services and put her under 72-hour protection. However, this physician named Ruby Schwartz, who was a consultant pediatrician, diagnosed Victoria with scabies and decided that it was scratching that had caused her injuries.
Okay.
And so she made the diagnosis without speaking to the little girl by herself.
Always a good thing.
And
always talk to your patient.
Right. And so she was released back into Marie's care with no further investigation on July 15th. And then on July 24th, so a little over a week later, Victoria was taken back to the emergency department by Marie.
Okay.
With severe scalding injuries.
Ooh.
And she claimed that they were self-inflicted because of the scabies. She said that Victoria had dumped the scalding water on herself because she was itching so much and she was trying to get it to stop.
False.
Yep. So after that hospitalization, from then on, Marie kept Victoria away from hospitals and turned instead to churches.
Oh, good.
And she said to the pastors that she was Victoria's mother and that there were demons inside of her.
Oh, good.
And so the pastors at some of these various churches offered prayers to try to cast out the devil, and they all thought that her injuries were due to demonic possession. So between December 1999 and January of 2000, social workers did attempt to make three more visits to Marie and Victoria, but they didn't receive any answers. So for some reason, they assumed that the two had moved back to France.
Oh, good, good. Yep. Assumptions.
So then on February 18th, they wrote to Marie saying that if they didn't receive any contact from her in a week, they would close the case. And so just short of a week later, on February 24th, Victoria was brought semi-conscious and suffering from hypothermia, multi-organ failure, and malnutrition to a hospital. And despite medical care, she passed away the next day on February 25th, the same day that social services closed her case because they hadn't heard from Marie in a week.
Yeah, that's what it is. Rely on the abuser to
right. So the pathologist who examined Victoria's body noted 128 separate injuries and scars and described it as the worst case of child abuse she had ever seen. She'd been burnt with cigarettes, tied up for periods of longer than 24 hours, hit with various things like bike chains, hammers, and wires. And then, of course, she was suffering from hypothermia and malnutrition because they forced her to sleep in a bathtub in her own excrement. And
I wonder what the parents that sent her to France to get an education thought of all this when they found out.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I read somewhere that they only heard from Marie three times between when she took Victoria and when they heard about Victoria's death. And in all three of the letters that she sent them, she said, everything's going so well, and like gave them very positive updates. So yeah, Marie and her boyfriend, Carl Manning, were charged with child cruelty and murder. And on January 12, 2001, they were both found guilty and sentenced to life imprisonment.
Good.
So during her life in Britain, Victoria, who was eight at the time of her death, was known to four local authorities, four social services departments, and three housing departments, two child protection police teams, two hospitals, and a few local churches. And because she was known to so many organizations, they did this huge public inquest into the circumstances surrounding her death. Mm-hmm. And the inquest found that there were numerous instances where Victoria could have been saved, and found that many of the organizations involved in her care were very poorly run. And they made several recommendations based on those findings. And so this led to the development of numerous child protection related programs in the UK. So that's why this is one of the most famous cases there. But I thought it was interesting that the case that kind of kicked off the idea for this episode was an autopsy of a victim of suspected witchcraft, versus nowadays people who are getting autopsies are more likely to be people who are being accused of witchcraft and being put through horrible abuse and torture.
People are horrible people.
Yeah. So that's the murder of Victoria Limbier.
And as always happens, right at the end of the episode, Cole has decided to be active.
Yeah.
So now she's chewing on my finger, which is really comfortable. I'll do witchcraft with you. Do you want to do a spell? We can give out candy, and you can be the black cat. So when I was a kid, to end this on a happy note, speaking of black cats. So when I was eight, I got my first black kitten, and I named him Ninja because I did Taekwondo at the time and I had a black cat. So obviously he was going to be Ninja, and he was a little Ninja. And one of the first years that we had him, I wanted to be a witch for Halloween and have my black cat. So I was a witch and we brought Ninja around with me. Probably only made it to a few houses before we put him in the car because he couldn't deal with it anymore. But there was this one house we went to, and I was in my full witch's costume, and I carried this cat with me. And this woman opens the door, and she yells into her husband, like, hey, come out of here! This girl's got a real live cat! And I got a lot of candy because of my adorable little black kitten, who is way fuzzier than Cole is. But yeah, so on the witch's front, now be a witch for Halloween. I could be one again. Do you want to be my Halloween costume partner?
Yeah. I can just imagine you trying to trick or treat with Cole.
She doesn't really meow, though. She can't really meow. It's more like, eh.
Although when she was a kitten, she did attend a wedding.
Did she?
She did.
Why did she attend a wedding? Oh, thanks.
It was back when she needed to be fed every 2 hours. So Danielle, my younger sister Danielle, took her to my older sister's, like, city hall wedding to get the paperwork done so that Millie could immigrate.
Good. Step one,
get wife to U.S.
Oh, man. Oh, yeah. So we hope you enjoyed the episode.
Please remember to rate, review, and subscribe so that we get boosted up on various podcasting platforms and other people can find us.
You can visit our website at deadmendotellpodcast.com, where we link to all of our sources and the episode guide.
We're on Twitter at DeadMenDo.
On Insta at The Dead Tell Tales.
Our Facebook page is Dead Men Do Tell Tales Podcast.
And as always, you can send us an email through our website or directly to thedeadtelltales@gmail.com. And you can send episode ideas, corrections, comments, whatever you feel like.
Oh, that reminds me. When I was looking up this episode, that first autopsy that I talked about in the New World, the one on Siamese twins.
Yes.
Where their main goal was to determine whether it was two souls in one body.
Yes.
I found the autopsy report, and they saw that there were two livers. Even though they were fused, they had like two different gallbladders, so they thought they had their own livers.
Two different bladders of gall.
Yes, I'm sorry. Two different bladders of gall. So based on that fact, and also the fact that when they were alive, because they were these baby girl Siamese twins who lived for 8 days after their birth, they acted independently of one another. So based on the fact that they acted independently of one another and they each had their own liver, they were determined to be two souls in one body.
To be fair, the liver has a lot more use than they used to think it did. So it's maybe smart to have that be like the more important center.
The seat of the soul. Yeah. You're right.
I can see that.
Okay. And our opening music is Introducing the Pre-Roll by Lee Rosevere, who you can find on SoundCloud.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.